Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to our newest episode of Energy in Action. I am joined by Devin Schumann, and she is a wonderful woman who you will be hearing from throughout the year in a variety of capacities on this podcast. She is so knowledgeable when it comes to mitochondrial disease, and we know how rare that is. So she is here to tell us about herself, and we're going to talk a little bit about the last decade, we'll say, in mitochondrial disease history and get you up to speed on Devin before she, comes back to us for different content throughout the year. So welcome, Devin. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, I'm glad to join. This is fun. I love it.
Well, it is 2025 and we are going to make this podcast the absolute best it can be this year. And I personally think that if, we can introduce you to our listeners and then bring you back, I think it really kind of gives credibility to what you can give to our audience. And they'll become really used to you and your voice and what you have to say. And I think especially once they learn your story, it'll be very easy to connect with you as I have. So, Devin, do you want to tell us about your personal journey through mitochondrial disease before we kick off all the other stuff?
Yeah, sure. I'm always in my brain like, how do I make this into an elevator pitch? It's only been my whole life. But the best I've got so far is, so right now I'm in my young 30s. I wasn't diagnosed with mito until I was like in my teenage years, around 16 or 17. In hindsight, I think many of us play this game. There were some clues. I had failure to thrive as a baby. I was in the NICU. They were talking about sending me to CHOP. But then it just kind of got better and I never went in and had the workup. And so for me, I didn't really know kind of what I was going through. It wasn't just like the typical childhood experience till my brother, who's 2 years older than me, went through the diagnostic odyssey. And I joke, I rode his coattails, like he did all the first biopsies and the poking and the prodding and being the poor guinea pig of it all. And they figured out what he had going on when he was 16, 17, 18. And then they had a moment pause, looked at me and went, oh, that explains a lot. So I was missing like 80 out of 180 days of school my junior year. So there were a couple red flags that something was going on there. We didn't know I was immune compromised. We didn't know that I was triggering rhabdomyolysis, where all your muscles break down, from every school dance I went to. My brother and I both had a lot of fatigue. And so we were just like, oh, hey, she has fatigue, and didn't really connect the dots. They thought I had mono over and over and over again, which you hear from a lot of teens with mito who don't know that that's what they have. And then for me, it kind of was a whirlwind. I went off to college. I learned about the disability community by joining a disability college club my first week there. And so I always say I was figuring out what it was like to be an adult while I was figuring out what it's like to have mito, while it's like to be part of a disability world. And I went to my first UMDF conference that summer and met other teenagers with mito. And we started a Facebook group. Now it has like 500 plus members. That just kind of spiraled in a wonderful way. And yeah, for me, what I do for a living is I'm a genetic counselor. That first year of college, I also went to a free pizza lunch and they were like, hey, this is what genetic counseling is. And I was like, that sounds super interesting because I'm already Googling all of this anyways. And it just kind of all fell together. I was becoming a GC while figuring out what it was like to have an energy issue, and starting to go to more and more specialists and, do that fun checklist of, oh, hey, you're immune compromised. Oh, hey, you have tachycardia. Oh, hey, you have gastro issues, migraines, neuropathy, kind of like piling up the list. But yeah, what type me and my brother have was diagnosed via muscle biopsy. So we were, I'd say, one of the lucky ones that that was something that was still being done at the time commonly, and we got a concrete answer from it. We have mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome. And from there, we did some research and found a genetic answer. It's a recessive form of it. So we inherited it from our mom and our dad. And from there, now we found the gene. The paper just got published last year. We're trying to start a drug trial from a medication in Japan. And I don't know, it's been chaos and a whirlwind. And I feel like I've had mito forever. But then I realized it's really only half my life I've known about it. And it's just, how do you summarize your whole life?
I don't think you could have summed it up better. And it seems like you've really found a professional expertise that really makes sense for you.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, because again, so many of us become medicine nerds or genetic nerds, I think, just from having something like mito. You have to try to figure it out for yourself often. A lot of specialists or doctors you see don't know much about it. And as a little science nerd, I just kept everything I was learning seemed so cool and so interesting. And you don't have to find mito interesting if you have mito, but I feel like a lot of us do. I think a lot of us find it really cool when we learn about the newest scientific thing.
Tell me what happens after this pizza lunch. So were there organizations that were a part of it? Is that an undergrad major or?
Yeah. So genetic counseling is a master's degree right now in the US. And so, well, and in Canada. And so what you do is you get an undergrad in kind of whatever you want, but it tends to be science-based. So I had a psychology major. And then I had to take a bunch of chem, bio, neuroscience classes to get like the requirements for grad school. What happened for me is I was actually at a women's college. So after the free pizza lunch, I went and had tea with the presenter. We're at women's college. We all have tea. We don't have coffee. And so she had a slide where she said, this is when it clicked for me. I knew I wanted to do science, but I knew I wanted to talk to people. I loved having time with patients to actually get to know them and not quick 15-minute appointments. But I love the psychology of like the human nature of how do you process genetic info. And I just went up to her afterwards. I was like, that slide, I had the moment. You gave me the moment. And so we went and had tea. And then she came back 2 of the other 4 years I was there. And so we've had tea multiple times. We're still friends. And from there, I volunteered in a genetics office. I just called my local genetics clinic and said, hey, do you need a volunteer? My college has this cool program where they'll pay you to work for free for a summer because I know so many unpaid internships aren't accessible to most people who, you know, need an income. And so I worked for my local genetics office for a summer and that cemented it. I was like, I've seen the day to day. I like it. I want to do it. I accept that insurance is a giant pain in the ass. I'm willing to take that on. That was my big discovery of the summer. They're like, what'd you learn? I'm like, I hate insurance. They're like, perfect. You have a realistic expectation of the job. Welcome on. I went to grad school, got the degree, and then started doing it about 8 years ago now.
Do you feel like you have a unique personal connection with some of the people you talk to because you've gone through such a unique personal journey of your own?
I do. I think that for me, I am very casual with patients. Like I'm not a super formal human in my general sense, if you can't tell already.
And this is why you're so good for the podcast.
Again, formal is overrated. I do think that it's a different perspective when you have a rare condition and you work with patients who are going through the same thing. A lot of patients will make comments to me like, you just seem to get it. Or like, hey, what am I picking up on here? Because they can just tell there's something different happening, even if it's not me being like, by the way, I have a genetic condition. I have had patients Google me, though, and so they know I have a genetic condition. So I also don't hide it, even if I never centered around that. But yeah, I think for me, I summarize genetic counseling is sort of 3 roles. One is being a medical jargon translator. One is being like an emotion validator. and one is being a professional Googler. Like, you, there's always something you don't know and you have to figure out how do you get to the good resources and learn about it. And I think that middle one, the, you know, emotion validator, is where a lot of patients are like, I can sense something. Like, you're just saying a lot of supportive statements that, like, how did you know I needed to hear that? I'm like, because I've been there. A lot of healthier people get into the field because they have a personal connection, but not all. But I think I've even noticed that as a patient, right? When I have a migraine doctor who's had migraines, you can sometimes just tell. There's something there. You're like, have you been here? And they're like, yeah, I have migraines too. And I always appreciate that. I love when I can tell I have that with my doctors. And that's part of why I try to provide that to patients, at least in that same, if they're interested, they can know that about me, even if I don't say, hey, here's my whole story in an appointment. I will admit, when I was trained, they said you should never, ever, ever tell patients that stuff. But I really think it is changing. And I think it's partly changing because rare disease patients are going into healthcare related fields and saying, hey guys, that old school approach actually wasn't helping anything. So
it was hurting everyone.
I would think so, yes. but yeah, it's a changing world. And I think really for the better. I think you want to have someone that gets it, that goes, yeah, sometimes this just sucks. Like, there's no other way to put it. Trying to get answers is exhausting. Trying to deal with doctors not knowing how to help you and being hot potatoed from one doctor to another causes medical burnout. And I think if we deny that, you're just kind of gaslighting your patients. Like, oh no, this is an obnoxious process. There's a lot of hoops to jump through. Like, let's validate that and then talk about, well, what can we do with it?
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's no video here, but Devin can see that I am nodding my head as aggressively as possible because I feel like I live exactly what she said. But to have someone in my care team that could really make me feel like I'm not on this island by myself. Recently, I had a medical assistant ask me to spell mitochondria. I'm like, oh, we're not off to a good start.
I mean, yeah, I was going to laugh. You're nodding and I'm talking with my hands because that's what I do and nobody can tell. Lots of gesturing happens. But yeah, I mean, being a provider, I have dyslexia. So I always try to not judge if they can't spell it. But I think you're right. Like, that's often.
Oh, no, she wasn't familiar with it and asked about it. And then she asked the spelling. I should have been more specific.
Yeah. No, I'm just laughing because, again, I will type stuff into Google sometimes, but I think we've all had it where I've seen an ER doctor like looking you up on Wikipedia, like while you're in the ER with them and you're like, okay, but could we at least try a better resource than that? Like, fine if you've never heard of the weird thing I have, but please tell me that. Don't pretend you have. And like, at least get past Wikipedia, at least get like .gov or some sort of .org type website going on. I know you know better than Wikipedia people.
I hope everyone who's listening is like, oh my gosh, Devin is such a bright light and it's going to be so wonderful to hear from her throughout the year. So Devin, tell us a little bit about your involvement with MitoAction.
Yeah. So for me, the Mito community is the Mito orgs, right? Like, I think that's how so many of us find our people and find our, we jokingly call it with the teenagers, Mitoville, like find our Mitoville, like it's a little town. We actually want to buy a town and start it. That's our like lottery plan. If anyone wins the lottery, we're like, we're buying a town and just filling it with Mito people. And then we'll hire a doctor to come help.
Just going to say that has to be the next step.
Yeah, we're like, and how do we persuade a doctor? And which one do we drag along to Mitoville? But
maybe yeah. We'll vote.
Right. Like, again, we'll try, right? I just got to win the lottery first. Just a tiny first step there. But not that I play enough to win, but that's besides the point of a pipe dream. But no, for me, I learned about Mito and I went to a UMDF conference and there was the Mito Action booth, right? And like, that's who I was just talking to. I always rent one of those little scooters at the conference when I used to go. And we drive it around and, like, as a teenager, crash it into things and, like, knock stuff over. Well, like, that's how I met the Mito community, as they were like, oh, yes, there goes the little chaos teenagers grabbing chocolate and stuff off of the booths as they go by. And now we're, like, adults and providers and lawyers and, like, being on podcasts instead of just being, like, the teenager creating chaos. But yeah, I mean, I don't feel like there was a, like, when did you get involved? It's just kind of that organic thing. Like, these are your people. This is who you talk to. Eventually, I started doing more formal stuff with, like, Mito Action and UMDF. Like, we started Wondering Wednesdays with Mito Action a year or two ago now, where once a month, we just have an informal webinar where people can hop on and it's not recorded. And I just answer random genetic questions. And that started mostly because, one, both orgs kept calling me with patients asking questions, being like, what do I tell them? And two, Facebook, right? Like, you see all of these posts on Facebook of people saying things that are just not quite accurate about genetics. And I don't think it's anyone's fault when that happens, because, again, genetics is confusing. You may have never actually met with a genetics provider. You're trying to piece it together off of Google or one conversation. But I just kept getting tagged on posts of people being like, can you explain inheritance patterns? Can you explain what a gene is? And so we're like, oh, let's just, like, have a time where people can ask those questions to kind of open the door to those conversations and to figure out all the stuff that you don't always feel comfortable messaging your doctor about and be like, can you explain this basic concept again? I know you said it, but you said a lot that day. And so that kind of organically grew just out of the phone calls I was having with different Mito Action staff. And from there, I don't even know how we got it started. We also started a Mito provider call where it's people who have Mito who are health professionals who do it now once a month. And that was just because, again, people are like, have you heard of the doctor that has Mito in Florida? I was like, I haven't. Can you connect us? And so we're like, we might as well just make it a group because then we can find more people from there. So it's all. It's all that, like, if you build it, they will come approach to life, right? Like, you need it, so you make it. And then you see what happens.
Love your approach. I love your perspective. I feel like you're such an asset to this community because you do really get it. You're so personable. You're so easy to listen to. And you get it. You know a lot about this stuff. So thank you so much.
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, I love it, but it's also self-serving. Like, why did I start a teen group on Facebook? Because I met teens and I couldn't imagine not staying in touch. Why did we start a Mito Providers group? Because we wanted to connect and we're like, might as well make this accessible to others. I feel like so many rare diseases are shaped that way, where there's a family for a particular gene, right? We see this in the Mito community where someone's like, I can't find any other families with my gene. I'm going to go make an org just for that gene or a Facebook page. And it is sort of self-serving, but it also helps the community. It organically grows because sadly, there are not as many resources, I think, as we'd all want. And so it does shift the burden back on the community to create the resources that we need. Because if we don't, probably nobody's going to because everyone is busy and has important, busy lives. And, like, you can't create everything for everyone until you know it's needed, right? And that's the double-edged sword, right? You have an energy disorder, but you also want more support. So you have to put energy in to get stuff back. And we just see what happens.
Well, I think you've done such an amazing job. You've taken this gift of, you know, you understanding science and your willingness and just created amazing opportunities for people in our community. And so I thank you so much. So before we let you off the hook today, and again, you'll be hearing from her throughout the year on Energy in Action. And now all of our listeners know she is the voice behind Wondering Wednesdays and the face behind Wondering Wednesdays. So you guys can talk to her directly with questions you might have. And you can check that out on Mito Action's website. I want to spend a couple minutes. You know, you see things from such a unique perspective and you know so much more about all the Mito topics than many of us do. So do you think we could talk about how the community and research has, like, grown or shifted in the last decade?
Yeah, I think that it is really interesting to see how this world has changed, because in the moment, it's always like, ooh, what's this new cool science coming down the path? But then in retrospect, you look back, you're like, oh, wow, things have really changed in a decade. I joke to people a lot that I'm like, science is amazing because we know the most we've ever known and we know the least that we've ever known. Like, we always feel like we have this new shiny information, but we also are always guaranteed to be wrong about something that, looking back in a decade, we're going to be like, why were they telling anyone that? Like, that's totally outdated now. But what are you going to do, right? You have to work with what you've got. So for me, I think I've had an even more unique experience watching this change, not just because it's like I'm going to school and learning about it and getting involved and switching the role, but also because my form of mitochondrial DNA depletion syndrome is one of the rare forms that like a muscle biopsy can be definitive on and can really concretely say you have this. And there has been this shift in how do we diagnose mito in the 10, 15 years I've been in this community. And so, I mean, I always joke that if I didn't have a brother or if I was diagnosed now instead of then, I don't know if I would have found my answer, because I don't know if I would have checked the right boxes to get someone to do the right tests to get me to the answer. And so I fully admit there is a lot of privilege that got me to the position I'm in, and my path isn't accessible to everyone. And that is heartbreaking and really feels just weird to be like, this is the cool stuff I've done, but you can't get access to it. But also, again, I try to do what I can within the system. So to me, some of the big changes are, one, how do we diagnose mito? And what terms do we use? When I first entered the mito community, it was mostly a lot of talk about either the main types of it, MELOS, LHON, MRF, which is still definitely happening. But I think we're starting to realize that's not the vast majority of mito patients anymore. When I started, that was kind of considered like most people have one of those and then some people don't. But also we started switching our words. So we had like primary mito versus secondary mito. And we had mitochondrial disease versus mitochondrial dysfunction. And we keep redefining what we mean by that. And with that, we're redefining how do we test for mito. So to me, I'd say one of the big changes is with that verbiage, primary mito versus secondary mito started to be used in the last decade. And that was meant to say a primary mito is someone where you have mitochondrial disease or dysfunction due to a gene that affects the mitochondria directly that's causing it. Nowadays, that's often what we mean. Primary mito means you have a genetic diagnosis. But even a decade ago, primary mito could mean you have an abnormal muscle biopsy and we think it's due to mito versus you had a medication or another genetic syndrome that caused mito dysfunction secondary to that. So there are other neuromuscular conditions, other muscular dystrophies that can cause mito dysfunction, but we consider that secondary, right? Like we say you have Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, but yeah, we noticed in your muscle biopsy there were some mito changes, but we know it's due to the other thing. That I remember when we first had that PowerPoint at the conference, you know, and they were like, let's explain what primary versus secondary is, because it was brand new terms. And I think a lot of the change has come from genetics. I think because one, with genetic testing, we realized people that we had labeled as having mito might not. We did genetics and we found out, oh, you have a change in a totally unrelated gene and that's what's causing your symptoms. But also clinical trials. Clinical trials, it's really hard to study a medication in a group of people who have such different symptoms. And so to look for statistically significant changes, right? Like what you need to hit that marker to say we succeeded, you have to be able to correlate it. And so if you've got 1,000 people in a study, which it's impossible to have that many, but I'm just using it as an example. Well, not impossible, but we're probably not going to have it anytime soon. There's not enough of us. If you have 1,000 people and you see 100 people benefited, and you can go look and say, well, those 100 people all had the same type of mito, the same genetic change, you might be able to prove, hey, yeah, it didn't work for 90% of people, but for that 10%, this is why we think it's significant. So they can correlate it to other factors. But if you have 1,000 people and we don't know any of their genetics, and maybe half of them or a third of them actually have something different than mito, or have like mitochondrial dysfunction due to a medication or an injury or something like long COVID, well, that med might not work as well for them because it's targeting something different in the body, or what's causing their symptoms is from a different part in the cell. And how do you prove that if you don't know what's causing it for most people? And so I think as we had some clinical trials that included a lot of people and had trouble proving that significant finding, even if groups of patients were like, it really, really helped me, it didn't get to the point of statistically significant, they kind of took a step back and got really strict, right? And said, hey, I know everyone's eager to participate, but we need to know the genetic cause, and we need to confirm that to get something that's actually usable to then help the community. And so I think both from learning from genetics that we misdiagnosed some people and learning from clinical trials, hey, we really need this to be as concrete as possible to make our argument for this. It has kind of shifted what people have done. And there even was a paper right at the start of COVID where they said, but the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, which is a group of doctors, and they also did a paper. I want to say the paper included some international, because a lot of their papers do, but I'd have to fact check myself on that point. But they came together and they said, hey, we really are not as comfortable labeling people as probable mito or suspected mito, because they stopped looking for other answers. And so if we put that label on someone, nobody kept looking. And so maybe we found there is actually a different answer for their symptoms, but we don't know, because no one will keep digging, because they're like, you have the mito label, go live in Mitoville. But it also left patients in a hard spot, because not all of us have the super obvious chemical clues in our blood, or we have those, but they're not definitive. It could be mito, it could be something else. And so you can have a lot of clues that pile up, and we're like, we really think you could have mito. But now we're not putting that probable mito label on that people with the nice tall stack of stuff. And so they get left in the purgatory of, you don't have a diagnosis, which sadly in American healthcare can sometimes mean we think it's in your head, or we think that you're over-exaggerating your symptoms, or we think that it's not something I can treat, I being whatever doctor you're talking to. You don't have one of my conditions, so go find help elsewhere, and nobody will kind of provide a home for so many mito patients who don't have that genetic diagnosis, and they're just floating around on their own. And I think that's really changed the dynamic of our community. I think a lot of people get really frustrated with the system because of that, and have negative emotions about that paper or about certain providers or clinics who won't see them, even though their local doctors don't know what to do to help. I think it leads to a lot of people going, well, am I a legit mito patient, right? Like, I don't have a genetic diagnosis. Is it real or not? And it gets hard emotionally, I think, and physically and mentally, to navigate how this is changing. And I think it's hard to navigate doctors, right? Because a doctor that you saw 20 years ago maybe would have said, hey, this is the label we put on you, this is the treatment we recommend, this is how we diagnose it. And then you go back to see them 20 years later and they're like, oh, we are taking away that label, or we no longer do that anymore. Or you came here for a muscle biopsy, we don't do those anymore in this clinic routinely. Or you don't hit the criteria of which we do one, even though your friend had one done with us 5 or 10 years ago who has the same type of symptoms. And people don't understand, like, what changed? Why am I not getting the treatment at the center that my sister got or my parent got or my friend got when they went to the same doctor with what can feel like very similar situations. And there's not an easy answer for it. I can argue all sides of it in terms of what I think we should or shouldn't do, but it's a shift that's happening all over America. And it doesn't always line up with what they do in Europe or in Australia. And that also makes it harder because you talk to people online and they're like, well, I had that. Why do you guys not have access to that? And there's not always an easy answer. Well, this is why, or it's not an answer people know. Like, how is a patient supposed to know this is why this clinic shifted their approach over the last 20 years? Or why does the US disagree with the UK and how they treat something? That's really hard to figure out.
These are big topics. But I think that, you know, from what you've said, I have heard, you know, maybe like a few percentage points of what you've just said. And I could dabble in maybe telling someone that type of information, but it's interesting to hear it from your perspective and to see really where the problem has, or where things have shifted and kind of traded one problem for another problem. And isn't it true that if some of these people were given the label instead of just as purgatory, then they could be a part of the drug trials and then we would grow in numbers?
To be honest, not likely. The drug trials, because of the issues I kind of talked about where they had trouble getting significant results, they have their own. So like, usually what they have is the criteria that's online. Like, you must have primary mitochondrial disease. And often they'll say you must have a genetic confirmation. Even if you say yes to that and your doctor refers you, they still have someone review it. So they have their own team that reviews eligibility. So even if your doctor said, we think you have primary mito, even without a genetic diagnosis, the drug company would still have a team review it. And often they will then come back and go, I know your doctor referred you, but you don't meet what we need. And I've actually had that happen where my genetic answer was a research answer for a while. It wasn't, you know, a gene that's on the list of genes that people think of as this causes mito. And so when my family was put forward to one or two of the trials, I haven't participated in any, but my brother has, they had to like go call our doctor and like have the conversation and be like, hey, so you say this gene causes mito, it's not on our list, explain. And he had to explain, and then they let my brother in. So yeah, I mean, the thing is, I would say the label doctors place on patients is less helpful for getting into a trial, because I think they still are going to go dig through your application when you apply to join them. But it really impacts access to care. What hospitals will see you, what clinics will see you, if a specialist will see you or not. And if they do see you, how much do they dig for other answers, or how cautious are they? Right. So for some forms of mito, there's certain meds that you want to avoid. And for some people with mito, there's symptoms that were like, that's a classic mito symptom. And there's symptoms where like, they tried to blame mito, but we should probably dig in case there's another answer for that. And having that conversation, I think, can be harder when you're stuck in that undiagnosed purgatory, because you'll be like, I think I have this. I have a lot of things related to this, or one of my doctors thinks I have it, but these other three disagree. And so now it's in a battle between your doctors of who's right, especially if you see doctors in different hospital systems, right? Like if you see a private practice mito doc and they're like, we think you have mito. You go to your local hospital and they're like, we don't know who that person is. So we think you have nothing. And it puts the burden on the patient to decide who do they agree with? Who do they like? Who do they listen to? And to be honest, that's just not fair. Like, it's not fair, in my opinion, to put the burden on the patient when it's medicine that's failing them. We're the ones to figure out what they have. We're the ones that are playing hot potato with their life. We're the ones that are responsible for interpreting their results and their symptoms. And we just kind of push that burden back on the patients and blame healthcare being busy and overrun. And, yeah, it's messy. Healthcare is messy. It's definitely more of an art than a science a lot of days. But I feel strongly that like it's not a great direction we're heading as we put more and more on the patient. They have to get the records. They have to get the referrals. They have to bring everything back to their primary care and explain to their PCP how to do stuff. Most people, medicine is gibberish, and it's hard enough to juggle all your symptoms, let alone juggling managing your healthcare team. I'm not sure I know what the solution always is, but it's...
You can see where the problems.
Yeah, and I can see we're not headed in a helpful direction, sadly. And so people are trying to figure out, what do we do to counteract that? And I'm very lucky. I work at a nonprofit, and so I see patients, but assuming grants still exist by the end of this year, we have a lot of good grants that help with the goal of increasing access to genetics. So we can see patients in Alaska and patients who live in the middle of nowhere, Eastern Washington, where they can't get to a genetics clinic for hours or years, depending on the wait list. And I'm very fortunate that I think, at least in a tiny way, I'm helping to kind of address that problem. Not everyone has that luxury, right? If you look at work at a big hospital system, I'm not going to say it's your fault that you don't drive to 3 hours into the middle of nowhere and set up a clinic on the side of the road, right? I feel fortunate that I can at least try to help with that and raise awareness of the gaps we have right now to figure out what we can do, even if that's just meeting with a patient to explain why genetics isn't going to be helpful, which sometimes I do. And I'm like, I would love to help, but it's outside my scope. Like, you want me to order a muscle biopsy? I can only order genetic testing. I can't do procedures. Or you want to know exactly what meds to take? I can't prescribe meds, so I can't make medication recommendations. Or they want to confirm what type of mito they have. Their genetics have been negative so far. We do hit a point where we've tried everything we have. And we've done the biggest, shiniest tests that are out there. And it's not your fault as a patient that your answer wasn't in there. It's the fault of knowledge. We don't have enough knowledge yet to find your answer. And kind of explaining what we do know and what we don't know and what we can do and what we can't do, taking the time for that conversation also has value, right? Because I think so often a doctor tells us no, and that's a complete sentence. And we're like, well, why? Right? Like, but why are you saying no to that med? Or why don't you want to do a procedure? Or why do you not think I have that? And they don't pull up like the criteria and go, well, here's the checklist and you're not checking these boxes, right? Like, it means you have to Google it and figure it out and try to guess as to why they said that to you. And to me, I think that's one of those rare disease things I've learned. Like, you have to give the why, because it's not fair. It's the person's life wars. They deserve to know why you're making the decisions you do about their life and to be part of that conversation of the pros and cons.
Well, I think a lot of us can agree that the burden is often put on ourselves and it is really hard. And I think you definitely hit the nail on the head. Devin, I know you're going to be on a few times this year, but I think especially as the world changes and the exposure of mitochondrial disease awareness grows, hopefully you can come back on with the good news and maybe sometimes the not so good news, but you can share with our listeners where you're at with your personal life and with your professional world and how we can all help ourselves. And it's been a pleasure having you. I'm so looking forward to these couple episodes you're going to be a part of this year. So if you've enjoyed listening to Devin today, check back throughout the year to hear more from her. So thank you, Devin. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, I look forward to these conversations. Again, it's fun to have a new mito friend to talk to, right? And if we can help a couple people while we chat, I'll call that a good day.
Okay. So you're everyone's new mito friend. Enjoy it.
I'll take it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.